Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, international editor at Reaction. Throughout the West, a populist tide has been growing. From Donald Trump's entry into the White House in 2017, to the rise of Matteo Salvini's League in Italy, populism has been gaining ground. By speaking to widespread anxieties about immigration, inequality, and identity, populists have challenged orthodoxies about globalization and liberal democracy. So, will populism continue to strike a chord after the coronavirus pandemic? And will this fundamentally change the character of global politics? With me to discuss these questions on the podcast today is Matthew Goodwin, Professor of Politics at the University of Kent and co-author of National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast, Matt. What is populism and why has it been successful in recent years?
Well, we define national populism as a movement that seeks to prioritise the interests and the culture of the nation state and which argues that the people are being left behind or betrayed by a neglectful, corrupt or self-serving elite. A national populism, in our mind at least, is a movement that has a fairly distinctive tradition of its own right in Western politics. It is quite different from some of the movements that it's often associated with, like historic fascism and totalitarianism. It is a democratic force, albeit one that advocates a different conception of democracy, a more direct conception of democracy that prioritizes the majority view. And it is a movement that is a bit more than just a political style. And we've had a bit of a debate over the last few years about, you know, is populism a style or is it an ism? Is it an ideology in its own right? And certainly we argue that it has a number of key characteristics that give it a distinctive body of thought and an ideology in its own right. So it is a serious, I would argue, quite sustainable and in some ways quite coherent political force.
And has this crisis, the coronavirus crisis, been a good one for populists? Because in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has enjoyed sort of a bit of a bounce in the polls. And in the local French elections recently, Marine Le Pen's results were quite disappointing for her party, the Rassemblement National. And so do you think that national populism will continue growing or will this be a setback in many ways for certain populists?
Well, the first thing I would say is how we view political change, I think, is important. And in our book, National Populism, Roger and I take a very long-term, quite sweeping view of the evolution of democracy. And if you see current events through that longer term lens, then you realize how unhelpful some of the debates that we have had about populism have been. For example, 3 years ago, you might remember the so-called Macron Spring, where lots of people were excited about the election of Macron, and we had a discussion about peak populism. And in the same way, I think, you know, coronavirus has been very bad for populism, without question. Almost all of the populist parties around the world, from Bolsonaro's in Brazil to the AfD in Germany to Salvini in Italy, have struggled with a crisis that has demanded competency, expertise and nuance, all things that populists are bad at. But even this crisis, I think, should be seen within that longer-term lens. And that shows quite clearly that many of the underlying drivers that have been pushing people away from established mainstream parties, collapsing relationships between the citizen on the one hand and the mainstream politician on the other, growing concerns over the scale and speed of demographic and cultural change, a strong feeling of distrust towards established authorities, and also a relative sense of deprivation that I'm losing out relative to other groups in society. Those four drivers, in whatever society you look at, as we've been reminded in Poland recently with the election there, those four drivers, I think, are going to be with us for the long term. So even if Biden wins in November, even if Bolsonaro loses at the next election, you know, even if come the next UK general election, we see some kind of Labour-led coalition, although it still feels too early to be talking about another election in Britain. I think the way the structural changes in our politics, I think there's a consensus in my line of work in political science that those are going to be with us now for the duration. And there'll be different expressions, different manifestations, different challenges from one society to the next. But we are not going back to what you might call the golden age of representative democracy, where we had strong allegiances, strong alliances, and fairly predictable voters.
And this is one of your key points, really, Matt, is that, you know, national populism isn't just simply a kind of passing blip in the history of liberal democracy. It isn't just something which came about because of the global financial crisis. And so what I want to ask you is essentially, just as after the global financial crisis, it took a while perhaps for the populist tide to start coming into government, are we going to see a similar thing after this crisis now? Do you think it will have a sort of delayed effect, but perhaps halfway through the next decade, we'll be able to better appreciate how national populists have done from this crisis?
Well, I think if you look at the previous crisis, the Great Recession, and, you know, were we having this conversation as Lehman Brothers was collapsing and suddenly people were getting a sense of the scale of what was unfolding, then I think we would have struggled to guesstimate all of the political effects that lay downstream from that crisis. We probably would not have seen what was going on in Greece. We would not have seen what was going to happen with the referendum in the UK. We would not have seen the rise of for a while, significant populist parties in many of Europe's democracies. And I very much doubt we would have seen Donald Trump. And not all of those things were caused by the last crisis, but the last crisis did certainly cultivate some of the tributaries of their support, if you like. And in the same way as this crisis is unfolding, it's a much more complex crisis. It's a political, economic and health crisis. And that's why it's quite different from the Great Recession. As we look ahead now, we have to think quite seriously. Firstly, accepting, I think, that political volatility is going to flow from this crisis. We just don't know what it's going to look like. And brace ourselves for the fact that it will likely be very significant change, simply because of the scale of the crisis, the effects of the crisis. We can already see it's hitting the very same groups that have been leaving the mainstream over the last decade. And we can see that it is likely to overturn the issue agenda in politics. It's going to bring questions around redistribution, inequality, wealth, security, China, intergenerational tensions. It's going to really, I think, put a lot of that on steroids. And so as we stand here with the immediate sort of dust swirling around from the crisis, I think the only thing we can say with certainty is that there will be political change. It will come in the years ahead. The 2020s, will be a decade of volatility, I think. But we'll have to wait and see what those effects turn out to be.
And I want to ask you about this implosion of social democracy across the West. And one of the things driving this is the defection of the more socially conservative working class towards national populist parties. And as you say, in the US and the UK, this can be traced back quite a long way. So it's not just after the crash. It can go back into, well, you can trace it back into the 60s and 70s in some cases. So why was it only in 2016 with the election of Trump, or in the 2019 general election in the United Kingdom with the breaking apart of the Labour Party's red wall, that the dam really fell apart, as it were, for social democrats?
Well, social democracy has been struggling for a while. I think the decline of centre-left politics really kicked in around the mid-2000s and then gathered pace. And, you know, the warning signs, you know, were there with rising rates of apathy in working class communities, new populist parties, as you say, that quickly became the new working class parties, you know, often drawing more of their votes from blue collar workers than other parts of society. And social democracy basically ran headlong into a tension that had first been identified in the 70s and 80s where people pointed out that it was going to become increasingly difficult for social democratic parties to simultaneously satisfy middle-class degree-holding professionals who generally were culturally and economically liberal, and social conservative, non-degree-holding working-class voters who were, you know, instinctively small-c conservative on social and cultural questions and pro-redistribution on economic questions. And over time, you know, we've seen how that tension has basically erupted and pulled centre-left electorates in very different directions. And in some of our European systems, those parties have lost out to radical left and green parties because they're more culturally liberal middle-class professionals, or what Thomas Piketty would call the Brahmin left, a kind of higher educated section of society is broken off into more radical left options. Meanwhile, we've seen their workers drift off to, you know, Marine Le Pen or Nigel Farage or Donald Trump. And there is no way back for social democrats. There's no easy way back anyway, but I would argue really there is no way back now. They're going to have to completely overhaul their electorates, completely reshape their bases of support, because we've entered into a new era in politics where the primary questions are not economic and they don't relate to social class. The primary questions are identity questions that relate to our values and the nation and how we see the nation. And as those issues have risen up the agenda, immigration, Brexit, increasingly questions around diversity, national history, sexual identity, how we teach our children, how we view our country, all of those questions, all of those culture wars are exposing over and over again these differences and these distinctions within centre-left electorates. So, you know, fast forward to the 2019 general election, and what happened essentially was what some of us have been telling Labour was going to happen for 5 or 6 years. You know, we, as an aside, as an anecdote, we presented a lot of our early research to the Labour Party in 2014, saying that the Labour electorate was about to implode because it was unable to satisfy these different groups. And what we then saw at the 2019 election, exacerbated by Corbyn, exacerbated by Brexit, exacerbated by Labour's failure to respond on the identity axis. Basically, the end result of all of that was the collapse of the Red Wall and Boris Johnson's majority, which was the biggest majority for any political party since the 1980s, or for his party since 1987.
Are there any exceptions to this great implosion across Europe? For example, in Portugal and Spain, centre-left parties are leading coalition governments. It might be a very shaky and unpopular government in the case of Spain, but they are in government. So are these parties in Spain and Portugal managing to buck the European trend, or are they also in trouble in the longer term?
So there are outliers. Spain and Portugal, you know, but also Denmark. And you can look at cases, for example, we may see in the United States too, perhaps with the election in the autumn, cases where centre-left parties are managing to reclaim or hold power. But that should not distract us from the fact that they are still based on incredibly shaky, fragile coalitions that are in many ways quite incoherent. And holding those coalitions together was easier in an era where politics was much more strongly defined by class than it is in an era where politics is much more strongly defined by these competing identity, you know, these identity conflicts. And, you know, if you can look at Spain and Portugal, and you can look at most European party systems, and you can say, well, the key message of the last 5 years has been fragmentation, a larger number of parties breaking through and winning votes. And that's made it harder for European states to get the strong and stable ideological governments, ideologically coherent governments that they need during this moment of continued crisis for the European Union. Denmark is an interesting case because Denmark has not had a traditional social democratic party in the sense that it's had one that has been willing to be fairly conservative on the identity axis while mixing that with the kind of classic Danish sort of redistributive type economic politics. And that's been quite successful. And in Sweden, interestingly, we've now seen the Swedish Social Democrats also modify some of their positions on these questions. So I think we are beginning to see social democracy evolve and move. It is constantly going to be under pressure from the left, with radical left parties and green parties, especially among the upcoming Zoomers and millennials who really do put a high premium on issues around climate change and environmentalism, but also those working class voters, socially conservative, deeply patriotic and deeply anxious about the direction of their societies. And it's not going to be an easy few years for social democrats on any measure. And I'll just add, if anybody has shown the way through these value divides, in my mind, it has been conservatives. I mean, there is a reason why two of the prominent leaders in Europe, arguably two of the most successful leaders of Europe at the moment, Boris Johnson and Sebastian Kurz, have both, I think, struck a formula that can navigate conservatism through this era of value divides, which is, you know, by moving a little bit left on questions of the economy and moving a little bit right on questions of culture. And Johnson, so far, Johnsonism, it may change, we'll have to wait and see, but so far he has managed to do what, you know, Macmillan and Disraeli and Baldwin and others did, which is understand that the true strength of conservatism comes from when it is a one nation brand, not a narrow, quite targeted and divisive brand.
A lot of people on the center left who are quite anxious about national populism put their faith in this idea that there's going to be some great generational shift in values, and that in 10 or 20 years time, the center left will again have a kind of demographic dividend among young Zoomers. Is this wise from centre-left parties, or is this also a misguided hope?
I think the effects of generational change are still being debated. It's certainly the case that, in very broad terms, Britain has gone through a sort of a liberal drift as successive generations have gradually become more liberal on some questions, not all questions, but some questions. And we've seen that result in some pretty profound policy and political changes. For example, Britain's membership of the European Union, a much more relaxed approach to immigration, the proliferation of social liberalism more generally. But we should remember that politically, that has not resulted in successive Labour majorities. It's not resulted in a sort of rise to dominance of, you know, a new era of woke type politics. Zoomers are a little bit more complicated than people often suggest. And, you know, we now have a number of reports that show that, yes, they are typically very liberal, but they're also not very experienced. They're less likely than millennials to have gone into the world of work. They're also quite fiscally conservative. They're also, I think, quite less focused on the self and more focused on experience and authenticity. And while they are strongly supportive of the Labour Party, they're less likely to vote, as we discovered in December 2019. So if you put all of those things together, the picture is a little bit more nuanced than some of our friends in the media would have us believe when they talk about a linear, inevitable victory for kind of liberal progressives. And I think there is an opportunity for conservatives generally around the environment, which the conservatives need to be much more assertive on, around the intergenerational contract and what the conservative vision is for that particular issue. And even on some more recent things that we've seen over the last few weeks, like the issue of Hong Kong and the issues of defining what global Britain really is and what it means and what it looks like. You know, there are opportunities for the conservatives that may allow them to reconnect with these more recent generations. So I'm not as gloomy and pessimistic as some, but there are some significant challenges.
I'd like to turn back to the national populists now. And one of the things that you've pointed out before, Matt, is that while there are a lot of things which unite national populists everywhere, they're also not homogenous. They're not the same everywhere. And one of the issues in Europe is that there is an east-west divide among national populist parties? And does the particular historical experience in places such as Poland and Hungary, you know, they have deeply religious rural populations, they have the experience of reasserting their sovereignty against the Soviet Union, which isn't something that Western European nations really have. Does this mean that there's much more of a market not only for national populist politics, but also for a more authoritarian and illiberal style government than there is in Western Europe?
I think the experience that you point to is important. I think if you read some of the recent contributions by people like Ivan Krastev, who has made this argument that Central and East European states were not instinctively in tune with some of the social liberalism that came with being in the European Union, and that, you know, there was a fundamental disconnect at the heart of the project that many people in the West didn't quite understand. And the influence of religion, the influence of family, I think it is incredibly important. I think something I'm writing at the moment about how societies in the West are gradually moving into an era of not just liberalism, but hyper-liberalism, where many of those institutions have broken down, kind of left people searching for a sense of belonging and meaning that I think in some respects isn't really there. Whereas Central and East European states are very different. They are more, you know, social capital, I think, is more visible. Values are more traditional. And on the supply side, they have more political leaders and parties who are willing to send a direct cue or a signal to conservative voters that they will do things like defend the family, that they, you know, will voice skepticism about the pace of social liberalism, that they will try to shape national institutions, albeit in ways that people will find uncomfortable and might oppose. There is a stronger supply side factor at work in those societies, which we often don't have, or we've not been used to having in many of our own societies. And that was obviously what was so distinctive about Trump in the US, was that he was the first politician, really, since people like Pat Buchanan and Barry Goldwater and perhaps Nixon, to really give that signal to voters that he was willing to be, you know, quite overt on some of those issues and those divisive issues. So I think the experience in Central and Eastern Europe is very different. And if you look at the latest election results that we've had, for example, the recent ones in Poland, and also looking at how Fidesz and Orban have done, and looking at the trajectory in several other states, national populism, if it is embedded anywhere, if you want to find where it is embedded most strongly, it is in many of those states.
And so do you think national populisms one day might diverge in terms of their values in fundamental ways? Because there are national populists in Western Europe, such as Geert Wilders, obviously, who are very passionate about talking about things such as enlightenment and LGBT and women's rights and the independence of the judiciary, etc. But what we've seen in Poland and Hungary, perhaps, is that these sorts of values have been eroded and don't have the same kind of importance, perhaps, or the priorities of national populist movements there are elsewhere.
I think it's a very interesting observation, but not one that I think will be visible in some of those societies anytime soon. I think what was interesting about Wilders and his successor today in the Netherlands and before them, Pim Fortuyn, is that they were basically using elements of liberalism to attack other elements in society that they found uncomfortable. And in that particular case, they used liberalism's defense of same-sex marriage and same-sex rights to attack and criticize the growing influence of Islam within Dutch society, an argument that we've seen, you know, Marine Le Pen and others make as well. And what's interesting is if you look at some of the recent studies on national populist electorates, it does suggest that in some countries like the Netherlands and France, they are actually attracting, you know, not majority support by any means, but significant support from LGBT communities. And that's something that we've not seen before. I don't think that will be transferred into Central and East European states, for reasons that we've discussed, they're far more conservative and already far more hostile to some of those issues more generally. But the million-dollar question for national populism in my mind is they can always recruit among manual workers and among, in some cases, the self-employed and the squeezed lower middle class. But can they break into the middle class? Can they win over women? Can they win over the young? And in some cases, they're more successful at doing those things than in others. But until they can begin to branch out from some of those groups, the groups that they're in now, they will forever struggle to get the kinds of levels of support that they need to control the corridors of power.
I'd like to turn now to the big battle which is looming on the horizon in November, and that's the presidential race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. You've written recently that Trump is really in trouble in the polls.
Well, I think obviously this is the big contest of 2020, and it's not going the way that that we thought it would. The coronavirus crisis, you know, has thrown a massive variable into the mix. Trump's campaign assumed that this was going to be about jobs, China, and the wall. And it has become instead an election that is, in a way, much more to do with the management of an incredibly complex crisis. And then by extension, the issue around protests, George Floyd, and interpretations of national identity. If you look at the numbers just coldly, then at this point, Biden is averaging an 8-point lead, and he's in a much stronger position in many respects than Hillary Clinton was at this point in the cycle. And yes, the some of the polls in 2016 had a difficult time, although some of the polls actually were pointing to the surprise, as I wrote at the time. But this time around, Trump's camp, I think, really is they are the underdogs. They've got a lot of work to do. Trump is not able to hold the rallies in certain states because of the COVID crisis, which I think is an important part of the campaign that very few people have picked up on. He is not doing well or as well as he was on the crucial question of who do you back to run the economy. He used to have a much stronger lead on that question, but no more. And so far, the campaign that he's trying to run to draw attention to Biden's unsuitability for office and his sort of raising questions over his mental capability, alongside, you know, sort of basically projecting, you know, disinformation around how he's been running the crisis and managing the crisis, has had no cut through in the polls over the last 4 or 5 weeks. And having watched an interview, quite a long interview with Trump this week, it strikes me that what he's inevitably going to end up doing is doubling down on his core constituency and run a core vote campaign, which will be turning up the volume against China, against immigration, on the wall, and trying to frame the Democrats as radical socialists that want to turn America into Venezuela, to quote Trump. The problem he's got is that in some of the key states, demographic change has been working against him. And the protests, I think, are going to become a proxy that will end up raising turnout among key groups for Biden, African Americans especially, but also millennials and Zoomers. And if all of that happens, then it's very difficult to see what path to the White House Trump has. And so he may end up as being the first one-term president since Bush Senior.
And do you think, to a certain extent, Biden is taking the sting out of Trump's message to white working class voters and non-college educated voters too, because he seems to be doing well in places such as Florida, Michigan, and Wisconsin that were won by Barack Obama but were then lost by Hillary Clinton? So is there a sense that Biden, partly because of his personal background, you know, he spent a lot of his time as a lawyer and as a legislator in Congress, but he was originally from a working class background in Pennsylvania, Scranton, Pennsylvania. Is there a sense that Biden has the ability to reach out to more white non-college educated voters in this way than Hillary Clinton did?
I think if you look at a lot of the polling data, I mean, it's clear in my mind that this election is not going to be a pro-Biden election. This election will be an anti-Trump election. We're seeing very little enthusiasm in the polling data for Biden, no matter what group you look at. in the same way that we didn't see really mass enthusiasm for Clinton. You know, it just, so I think, you know, will anti-Trump be enough for Biden? I probably, you know, in the end, I think it could be, given the polarization of the US and the sheer animosity, the mutual animosity between the two groups. But, you know, I think also the interesting thing with Biden, in a way, is can he just get to November without a major error, without a major problem? You know, can they try and limit the exposure and, you know, how the debates will go? I think, in a way, we've got lots of evidence to suggest that debates don't really make a difference. But this debate seems like it's going to have more riding on it than debates in the past. And by that point in time, if Trump is trailing in the polls, it may be the only thing he's got left to try and turn, to try and turn things around. So Biden, in a way, you know, he's not this, he's nowhere near, obviously, the same unifying, passionate, emotional, charismatic figure that Obama was. And he's not demonstrating the competence and the technocratic grasp of sort of detail that Clinton had. It's difficult to find a problem with Biden personally, as a candidate, as a person. So I, you know, my hunch is that he's going to do enough to hold things together and carry it over the line. But of course, what happens then is a whole other debate about, you know, the extent to which faction of the Democrat Party will end up essentially shaping and defining the Biden presidency. And also for the Republicans, if Trump loses, there is a huge existential question about the future of the Republican Party. Is it going to go in a sort of Boris Johnson direction that sort of Mark Rubio and others have been talking about, kind of leaning a bit left, being a bit sort of anti-corporate, Tucker Carlson, wrapping in those arguments about reaching into, you know, left behind workers while also keeping a firm line on cultural questions? Or is it going to go back to the kind of Bush sort of dynasty type politics, very relaxed about economic liberalism, wants to roll back the state, you know, and the sort of traditional fiscal conservative position? I think that's going to be a fascinating debate to watch if it happens.
And in a perhaps counterintuitive way, do you think that a Biden presidency would actually mean that the Democratic Party moves further to the left than if Trump stayed in power? Because it seems that what Biden really had going for him in the primaries was that, you know, his compelling argument essentially was, I'm the man to stop Trump. I'm a centrist. I can reach out to a broad coalition of voters. But once that Trump threat and the desperation to get Trump out of office is removed, is the Democratic Party perhaps freed up to continue going towards identity liberalism and a more statist approach to things such as environmental policy, for example?
I think it's a fascinating question. I think we are seeing a struggle for the soul of not just the Democratic Party, but liberalism. I think it's a struggle that will affect all of us. And there is no clear resolution. It's going to be a long-term struggle. I think the new identity liberalism, variously described as woke politics, inspired by critical race theory, a lot of those ideas are really going to change the face of liberalism, and in some respects, I think will encourage a debate about illiberal liberalism that we can already see finding its expression through concerns over freedom of speech and campus culture and how we interpret our national history. And, you know, what New Deal liberals did so well is that they came up with a message that cut across group boundaries. And what many of the early campaigners in the civil rights era did very well is they came up with a message and a formula that was colorblind, that talked about involving everybody in a new settlement and consensus that would give them a bigger share of the pie and would focus on integration, not only marginalized African Americans, but also poor, white, low-skilled workers. And it was that reaching across group boundaries that gave some of those earlier campaigns so much strength. Where we are now, and I think why people are right to question the new identity liberalism, is we've sort of somehow ironically ended up in a place where our group identities have never really been as racialized in the current era as they have now. And the whole narrative that comes with identity liberalism is to remind people over and over again about their racial identities and why they are not so much an individual, they are a member of a wider group, and those groups are fundamentally different from one another. The inevitable consequence of that will be not only to increase the salience of racial identities for African Americans, for example, but it will also be to increase the salience of a white racial identity. And there's quite a bit of research on this that, Ashley Jardina, Eric Kaufman, and a few others have shown that as we've gone through this populist moment, it's created quite a sharp backlash from voters who are becoming more aware of their identity and more likely to view certain issues through the prism of that racial identity. And that is what makes me incredibly nervous about this new brand of identity liberalism, because we are seemingly not talking about what brings us together, but rather what sets us apart. And that conversation is laced with racial and ethnic points of discussion that can easily trip into a highly polarized form of politics. So somehow, I think there needs to be a serious discussion about how we can also get some moderates in the room to stand up and make it clear as to what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable as we navigate these growing culture wars.
One question I think that a lot of people really want to know at the moment is, why on earth has modern liberalism gone down this path? It seems that classical liberalism has essentially been assimilated by conservative parties now. And what we have perhaps before the Cold War, but also definitely after the Cold War, is this liberalism, which, as you say, is increasingly obsessed with identity, that it is no longer about the individual. It becomes about collectivism. It becomes about expecting people to conform to what their racial heritage or their background dictates, rather than charting their own path in novel ways. Where did this come from? You said earlier that perhaps it's to do with this kind of existential angst that in an age of globalization and of great prosperity, people have lost sense of place. And does this come back to this post-Cold War hyper-globalization again, where people are really looking for something more spiritual to guide their lives?
I certainly think if you just take Britain as an example, and I'm writing about this at the moment, that you know one of the things that made Britain so strong in previous decades was its political culture, that it had a civic culture that kept people together and united on a common identity that was seen as being tolerant, moderate, where people participated, where they believed they could make a difference if they wanted to, where they generally trusted one another and they felt that institutions respected them. And if you then go through the post-war decades and you begin to see how many of the traditional anchors that used to keep people in a communal sense of identity, trade unions, religion, the family, representative political parties, have basically been hollowed out. I mean, I was looking at the data this week on religion. I mean, you can make a case that Britain is no longer a Christian country if you simply look at feelings of attachment to Christianity, and you look at the extent to which generational change is pushing us into a more secular world. And religion isn't the only part of the story. The family is another part, the fragmentation of the household. And I think that in very broad terms, you know, liberalism has got a lot of things right, and it's won a lot of important victories. You know, in an incredibly short period of time, it's ensured that women, same-sex couples, you know, marginalized groups have rights. But I think along the way, there have been some costs that we're becoming now aware of. Our societies are much more individualistic than they once were. There is a culture of narcissism that runs through many liberal leaders and commentators, and in general I think we've become more obsessed with the self, with status and esteem and recognition, and we somehow managed to build a society where the only people who get those things are people who have university degrees, and everybody else is deemed to somehow have failed in our settlement because they didn't go to the right university or get the right degree. And then we wonder why so many voters are feeling so frustrated and disillusioned and searching for meaning. And I think that partly where we are at the moment and why you're seeing these unparalleled changes in politics and the realignment of voters and, you know, the rise of populist parties elsewhere and voters desperately searching for something somewhere to kind of give them this sense of belonging and this sense that I am somebody, you know, in a wider collective. I don't just want to be an individual. I don't want to just be defined by my personal autonomy. You know, I want to be in a settlement where I have an obligation to others and they have an obligation to me. And I want to honour the contract that we have that runs through society from the dead to the living to the next generation. And I think that that's where the current developments in politics become, you know, quite important and quite significant. And identity liberalism doesn't give that. It doesn't align. It aligns you to a group, but in an incredibly negative way. And along the way, it repudiates everything that comes with your wider national group, your national history, your sense of nationhood, your ability to relate to people as fellow citizens. All of that is essentially relegated to your membership of a racial or ethnic group, and whether or not you get on board with these historical injustices and you want to define your life looking back at these historical injustices. And it strips out individual agency from the conversation completely. Yeah, you're not an individual anymore. You are a member of a victimized, persecuted, marginalized group. And so somewhere along the way, we've gone collectively from a culture that used to reward bravery and courage to one that increasingly gives prestige to victimhood. And I think that is incredibly unfortunate. And I think it's probably, by extension, a reflection of the way in which generations today do not have to think about some of the existential questions that generations before had to think about economic security, but also about physical security, about survival and getting through serious crises that gave people a sense of togetherness. That I think is no longer the case. You know, we have a generation with the Zoomers that is on track to be the most highly educated generation in history. But as I said before, it's also the least experienced. And yet it is also the generation that is most supportive of pulling down statues and reinterpreting national history and essentially wiping the slate clean. And that is what makes me incredibly nervous and anxious about this moment. And many of these positions are minority positions. They're not even majority positions. You know, they don't have majority support. Yet because we have a sort of leadership that is scared to be questioning these sacred values, they often end up being more influential than perhaps they should be.
And finally, Matt, it's easy to look at the state of the West in this respect and despair, but is this resurgence of cultural anxieties only a phenomenon in the West or in liberal democracies? Because if we look at countries such as Turkey under President Erdogan, where a powerful religious reassertion against secularism has led him to be in power for a number of years, or if we look at India, where Prime Minister Narendra Modi is asserting a kind of Hindu identity to try and balance out the insecurities created by globalization. Are we seeing a kind of wider populist reassertion of identity in global politics? And if so, does this say something fundamental, really, about human nature and the failure of the post-war liberal order?
I think, you know, in very broad terms, there is something in that. And I know that some of my colleagues have made an argument along those very lines, that we've lost that sense of recognition and collective identity that was once upon a time given to us through a very strong nation state with a shared understanding of our collective national identity, and which then began gradually to wither after the end of the Cold War. And liberalism was very good at pitching to the individual, but was really terrible at pitching to national groups. You know, it was either universal humanity and a kind of meaningless sort of civic nationalism that can be apply to any nation state and doesn't really relate to your specific context. It's from that to the individual with nothing really in between. And I think, therefore, as you rightly point out, whether you look at Brazil, whether you look at India, whether you look at Turkey, Hungary, and even here, you know, where we saw, you know, the Brexit revolt primarily was a desire to reclaim national independence and national community from what Peter Mayer called the void that had opened up through an excessive transnational technocratic governance that was neither particularly transparent nor particularly accountable. And again, we've seen this quest to return to belong and to return to somewhere. And in many cases, to return home as people see their countries. And that now has opened up this really interesting moment that we're in, which is, well, how is liberalism going to reply to this? And I hope that that reply is not what we're seeing currently, because that is really not an adequate, effective, serious reply. How is liberalism generally now going to reply to give people a counter message? You know, the jury's out on that one. The jury's out, but so far I think it's looking set to be a pretty bumpy ride.
Matt, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Next episode, I'll be joined by Karen von Hippel and Robert Fox to talk about NATO and Western security.